This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across the state this time of day. The real Main Streets, where we meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds, are important places in our communities where we, you know, share what we're talking about that day. And today we're going to be talking about what is good government in North Dakota with a couple of people who've got a fair amount of experience with the topic. And we should mention that that was the question that was asked in a public conversation at UND on January 30th, hosted by the Northern Plains Ethics Institute and ThinkND, supported by the North Dakota Humanities Council and the Bush Foundation. And joining us are the two discussion leaders. Dr. Paul Sum is the chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UND. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Mike Jacobs is a familiar voice on Prairie Public and Main Street. He's currently a columnist and was formerly the editor and publisher of the Grand Forks Herald. Thank you for being with us, Mike.
You bet. Thank you.
Let's start with what is the Northern Plains Ethics Institute, Paul? I realize that it's based at a rival institution, NDSU, but give our listeners an overview.
Well, we don't consider them a rival. They're part of the system. And
I consider them a rival.
Here we go.
I say that in all honesty. My department works pretty well with the folks at NDSU. The Ethics Institute has a number of initiatives that explore good government and quality of citizenship. It's something that we do at the Department of Political Science, Public Administration as well. So we have a lot of shared interests.
I should clarify, actually. I'm always for NDSU, except when they're playing UND.
Very good, Mike. Well, tell our listeners what ThinkND is, Mike.
My understanding is that ThinkND is a public interest group that that wants to examine contemporary issues in North Dakota. It has some intellectual and some financial power behind it, and it's presenting these discussions around the state, culminating, I think, on the 15th of April at the Heritage Center.
Oh, I look forward to that. This is, as I mentioned, a series of conversations. Paul, set the scene for us. What did it look like on a cold night in January at UND?
Well, we were competing with the State of the Union address, number one. Despite that, we had pretty good attendance. I'd say there were about 40, 45 in attendance.
I think 40, yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say they were split between students and members of the community, sprinkling of faculty.
Well, let's get into it, Mike. Just give us a broad thesis from your perspective. What makes good government?
Well, you know, my my interest really, I think, was in the question. There were a series of questions that were asked.
Yes.
And one was, what makes a good citizen?
Yes.
And my takeaway really from the whole evening was that there's a very big hunger to know about and understand how government works. There's certainly an appreciation in that audience, at least, and I have to believe that they are they may not be a perfectly representative audience, but they are certainly a sample of the citizenry of the state. So I was really struck by, first of all, their eagerness to know about how government worked and why it works in the way that it does, and then their deep concern that it work well. So I gave my little morality lecture about how responsibility lecture I should say, I guess, about how it really is the responsibility of individual citizens to be alert and aware and engaged, and I think that's the most powerful message to get across. Because, of course, we're talking in the context of North Dakota, which has an extraordinarily transparent government. We have the nation's broadest open meetings and open records laws, And it's also, in many ways, the most participatory government among the 50 in the United States. It has a very large level of participation, voted both in office holders and in voting turnout, and it has the nation's least difficult thresholds to put questions in front of the citizenry through the initiative and referendum and through the openness of the legislature, where every issue that arises must get a vote on the floor. Unique, those things, either at the cutting edge or unique in American politics.
Well, Paul, the fact that those people were there suggests that they were motivated and showing good citizenship by getting involved in this particular enterprise. From your perspective and the interaction with the audience, what were the descriptions of good citizenship that you heard?
There were a number of approaches that people took. I think the main focus was on participation and becoming involved, staying involved, being informed. What came out of the discussion was a bit of a paradox, because while that was clearly the sentiment that people held, the number of people also noted that people are not going to meetings, hearings are not well attended, various representatives at the district level would hold meetings and they would have two people show up. And so while there is this statement that people want to be involved and they want to be informed and they want to communicate with their representatives, on the other side, when it actually comes to action, they acknowledge that people don't do that as much. And I think that is a paradox that we have with any kind of representative government.
Yeah, I think just to add to that there was a sense that they didn't necessarily know what the best way for a citizen to become engaged, and they were pretty critical actually of news media for not being as enthusiastic, shall we say, or as obvious about providing this information as we in the business mm-hmm. always think that we are. My column this morning in the Herald laments having to listen to people complain about work that we in the media think we're doing relatively well, but right. clearly people in the public don't necessarily share that view.
Can you give us an example of what that would be like? What was there a specific?
Well, there are a number of young people, students, stated that they felt the media was very out of date, that they weren't taking advantage of social media vehicles the way that younger people would respond. And it made it very difficult. It made younger people at least feel that there was a lot of distance between them and not necessarily the representative government, but the communication channels through which they would have access to that.
Well, the president tweets a lot. That's not necessarily good communication. It seems to be effective.
Yeah, it definitely reaches an audience. But they were talking more about when public meetings would be held, what sorts of issues might be debated at various levels at various times. And so while the younger people were lamenting that the social media was not serving their needs in a way that they felt was compatible with their interests, a number of other people, let's say of a different older generation, felt that the newspaper was not doing a good job of that, that the other traditional vehicles through which you might find out about public events and again, mostly hearings and the workings of government, they were also failing. So Mike might want to comment specifically on that. But I remember there was at least a few people that felt that should be a political party meeting that should be freely announced in the paper, things like that.
Yeah. I think that traditional media, we'll call them, haven't done a very good job of communicating to people what it is that's available in the newspaper on a regular basis, or in other media outlets as well. So that's one thing. The other is that this notion that information is hard to come by has multiplied over the last number of years, I think because information is so much easier to come by. There's just so much out of it out there.
Yes.
That people are frustrated about how they can deal with all of this information. You know, when I was back there in journalism school, we all learned about the gatekeeper function. And, you know, the idea was that there were reporters and editors who filtered all of this stuff and put it in the newspapers or in radio stations or television. But there is no generally accepted filter today. You know, every individual has become their own filter. The fancy term for this is you have to curate your own media. And that's a change which I think customers, shall we call them, of traditional media, they haven't opened up their own media consciousness to absorb these new outlets, nor have people who are media savvy and trained to the new media outlets, which are popping up around us every day. They don't open themselves to the other sources of information that exist. So what really has to happen, I think, is and this is my rant that are my lecture that I give at all the intro to communications classes. What you really must learn in college is how to handle information, how to get it, how to evaluate it, how to act on it. And I think that in a sense, that's what people were telling us that evening was how do we get in there and be involved in a responsible way that will actually produce the good government that we say we're interested in.
Okay, don't be surprised if you seem brilliant in an echo chamber. let's go to another question here, though, because I think this is really intriguing. I'd be interested in picking your brains about this. What makes a good legislator or a good governor? What makes a good political representative?
And you know that there's going to be lots and lots of answers to that. And our audience produced many of those. You know, without going through a list, although I have a number of things in mind, one of the comments that struck me as being particularly telling was somebody said that a good representative is someone who holds and displays the values of that community that they represent. And so they started moving away from some of the earlier comments that were much more content-based, you know, and a little bit, you know, they want people to be responsive, they want people to be inclusive, they want people to be objective, they want people with a vision, they want people that are good at communicating. But then that idea that the person represents the values of the community and the best of the community, I thought really struck the nail on the head. I like that more than some of the other ones because the other ones, you know, whether someone's inclusive or not, whether one's listening, a representative listens to everyone or listens to the proper people, it's so subjective. And yet this idea of values, to me, struck a chord.
Paul Sum is chair of the UND Department of Political Science and Public Administration. He and Mike Jacobs participated in a January 30th public conversation titled, What is Good Government in North Dakota? Mike, the same question for you. We're in this hyper-partisan environment these days. What makes a good legislator or governor?
That, you know, that's a difficult question. My theory about North Dakota is that we seek, particularly in the governorship, somebody who represents our shared values, and most importantly, perhaps, our shared aspirations. I could give examples, but I think the current governor, Doug Burgum, in some ways is was elected because he represented what we want to be. You know, and there are lots of different notions about what we ought to be specifically, but he was able to communicate a big vision. The other governor, in my experience, who very much expressed what North Dakotans thought they wanted to be, was Art Link, who was a sort of down home, out west, aw shucks kind of guy.
Answered the phone.
yeah, exactly. Who very much expressed the North Dakota values of the time, which were really to be distinctive, to be recognizable as someplace other than Minnesota or Georgia or any of the other states. It was an expression of what we thought of ourselves, and of what we wanted to be. Just the way that Doug Burgum, who is in some ways almost the polar opposite politically, and the way he represents himself, does that for North Dakotans today.
I noted in a story from last November when the Northern Plains Ethics Institute was starting this series of discussions that Dennis Cooley, the institute director, was quoted as saying that North Dakotans have reported that trust in government has eroded. They feel that rapid changes in everyday life and government at every level have left many of them disconnected, if not reeling. Facts seem often to contradict one another. Legislators are not as accessible as they used to be. Concerned citizens attending government hearings often feel dismissed. So something's going on out there that the Institute is concerned about. And I'm just wondering, I'd like to get your reflections on that notion, Mike.
Well, I don't want to be a contrarian necessarily, but this ain't nothing new. There's been a sense of disengagement or even alienation in American politics from the very beginning. I think it is appropriate always and in every instance to be concerned about that. But I don't think that it is something that is unique to today. I mean, I've covered government politics in North Dakota for a very long time. I dare say, with the passing of John Andrist last month, I might be the dean of a graybeard journalist in the state. Yeah, I've been around a long time, and this is not the first time these notions have been raised. What's different is, I think, again, that there is so much information available, and it's difficult to process. And the other is that so many people are processing it from a very narrow personal point of view, whether that's ideological or partisan or religious or local gender based or whatever. We have sliced up the electorate in so many different identities, and each of those pursuing its own agenda has created a divisive political climate and a very difficult media climate.
Last Wednesday, there was a proposed ballot measure looking for a North Dakota Ethics Commission that was presented to the Secretary of State. They want to get it on the November ballot, meaning they're going to need about 27,000 signatures. Paul, North Dakota does not have an Ethics Commission. People claim the state's politics are real squeaky clean. What's your take on this particular proposal?
The proposal is fine. I don't have any objections to creating commissions that would try to filter through a lot of information that moves through government and looks at relationships between government and private parties. I'm not sure how successful it would be. I don't know how effective it would be. Corruption is notoriously difficult to identify by its very nature. It tends to be behind closed doors. It tends to be under the table. And so it's very difficult to observe. And when you have a commission that's looking into certain kinds of activities that's positive, I think that already happens by and large through the legislature. This would give it more permanence. It might give it more visibility. And so that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, North Dakota in terms of corruption was evaluated by the organization 538. And depending on the measure you're looking at, it comes out looking very good or very poorly. So one of the things where it looks a little bit on the poor side is the number of federal, the absolute number number of federal violations. You know, does that mean that there's a problem here, or does it mean we're very good at catching people? It's, you know, you don't know how to look at it exactly. So you can also look at the way that various experts have assessed it. And again, through the 538 site, it ranks anywhere between 46th, meaning not very corrupt at all, to number 8. And part of the those that are very critical were those that said, you don't have a commission, you don't have a formal framework that would process claims and look into things that might deserve to be looked at. So I think, I think it's I have no problem with it, but I'm not sure how effective it's going to be.
Mike, this has been a political football between the very dominant Republican Party in North Dakota and the small Democratic force in the legislature. What's your take on whether there should be an ethics commission and, for that matter, whether it would be effective?
There should be an ethics commission because it will be another tool for journalists. It will bring attention to the way that things are done, the way that politics are played, the way that agreements are reached. Whether or not it will reduce ethical violations or make the state's politics any cleaner, I think that could be debated. But as I say, it'll be a tool for journalists, and I'm for journalists' tools.
Mm-hmm. You know, getting back to the question about trust in the institutions, though, an ethics commission is not going to elicit more trust. It may very well elicit less trust. And when we think about trust in institutions, whether it's the legislature or the governorship or local government, that's a measure of performance, right? So trust or confidence that people have in their institutions, the way that people process that and the way it comes out in public opinion polls, it really reflects their satisfaction with the performance of institutions. And part of the problem that institutions across the country are dealing with is that the problems that we face today are largely out of control of the government. When we look at something like the stock market and the economy and the way it swings, like right now you have a downturn in the stock market. That is largely due to external forces, sell-offs in Asia, other sorts of things that are happening in Europe, and that's the impact it has on the U.S. And people don't put the problem that they're facing and the solution that they're expecting in proper perspective. So many of our problems these days are of a global nature. They are beyond what the government can reasonably be assumed to be doing. And frankly, I think the government does a pretty good job in a lot of these matters. And so that lack of trust is more a product of dissatisfaction with government not being able to solve problems that it was never designed to actually address. And so ethics commissions and things like that, again, I have no problem with it, but I just don't think that it's the solution that that is going to fix the actual problems.
Paul Sum is chair of the UND Department of Political Science and Public Administration. Mike Jacobs is a current columnist and former editor and publisher of the Grand Forks Herald. Mike, thanks for being with us today.
You bet. Thank you very much.
And Paul, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We were talking about a recent public conversation, What is Good Government in North Dakota? Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura will have a natural North Dakota essay. Then we'll talk with Dan Hendrickson. He's the communications manager for the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota in North Dakota. We'll be talking about complaints. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. No other metro area in the country lost construction jobs at a faster rate last year than Grand Forks. That's according to an analysis released today by the Associated General Contractors of America. AGC spokesman Brian Termail says about one in four jobs were lost.
Between December 2016 and December 2017, the Grand Forks metro area lost 1,000 construction jobs, which was a 24% decline in total construction employment. Again, that's the fastest rate of decline in construction employment in any metro area in the country, and the sixth largest total number of construction jobs lost during that same time period.
Russ Hansen, the executive vice president of the North Dakota AGC, says spending cuts by the State Department of Transportation have had an effect.
From 2011 to 2015 bienniums, they were looking at $700 to $800 million a year for a highway funding budget. Next year, the state of North Dakota is looking at a $290 million, $300 million funding for transportation, significantly decreased. And it's going to have an impact not only on jobs, but on the quality of the infrastructure.
Termail says there is hope, with President Trump asking Congress to invest $1.5 trillion in infrastructure over the next 10 years.
The dynamic of it is, if we can get past this immediate kind of crisis of the moment in Washington, that we've got a good chance of getting this enacted. But certainly it's going to take Republicans and Democrats to work together to get this passed. So we're cautiously optimistic.
Sally Miscavige of Op Construction in Grand Forks said her company usually hires 30 to 40 new workers in each construction season. She said the company did not do that last year. He was appointed to the Public Service Commission in 2017 by Governor Doug Burgum to replace Brian Kalk. Now Brian Crotius is running for re-election to serve out the remaining 2 years in Kalk's term. Crotius says when he interviewed with the governor and his staff, he told them one of his top priorities on the PSC would be to ensure responsible infrastructure development.
Our job is to make sure it's done right. Our job is to make sure that when the infrastructure projects come forth and are presented, that they're done responsibly, they're done correctly, and they're following the rule of law. If they're not done correctly, it slows development.
Crotius says another priority is to make sure North Dakotans are paying an affordable price for electricity and natural gas. If Crotius is elected in November, he could run for a full 6-year term on the commission in 2020. And a candidate for the Republican nomination for Secretary of State says it may be time for North Dakota to adopt voter registration. But the incumbent doesn't share that view. Will Gardner is challenging incumbent Al Jaeger for the nomination, and he said he would support ending North Dakota's status as the only state without voter registration because it would help prevent voter fraud. But Jaeger says he doesn't support making that change. The Democratic candidate, Fargo Representative Joshua Boshe, also says he would not support voter registration. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Bill Thomas. Well, the Prairie Public Valentine's Day tradition of the short and sweet drive is over. Thanks to Atomic Coffee and Sandy's Donuts and Nicole's, but especially big thanks to everyone who made a contribution. Enjoy those truffles if you got them, but certainly enjoy Prairie Public. You helped pay for it. If you missed it, we keep the door open till Thursday, prairiepublic.org or 800-359-4145. Thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Natural North Dakota is the name of a series of essays written and voiced by Chuck Lura about the plants and animals and natural phenomena found in our state. Chuck teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, but today he takes us south and west of there to talk about one of North Dakota's most important features, the Missouri River.
The Missouri River, the Wild Missouri, the Big Muddy. It's the longest river in North America and was a main artery in the Great Plains for Native Americans and early traders and trappers. And of course, it continues to influence our region in so many ways. It's like they say, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. Starting at the Three Forks west of Bozeman, Montana, with the confluence of the Madison, Jefferson, and Gallatin rivers, the Missouri heads northward towards Great Falls. From there, it takes a right turn, heading eastward to Williston before gradually heading southward through Bismarck-Mandan on its way to the Mississippi at St. Louis. It's a very different river today, with the main stem dam starting with Fort Peck, Garrison, Owyhee, Big Bend, Fort Randall, and finally Gavin's Point north of Sioux City. But if you're looking for a stretch of the river that can give you a sense of what the river looked like before construction of the dams, check out the stretch downstream from Garrison Dam to about Bismarck. It's a popular canoeing route, partially because of this. There are a couple other rather natural stretches of the river, such as the 149-mile stretch, designated a National Wild and Scenic River, from Fort Benton, Montana, downstream to the Charles M. Russell National Wildlife Refuge. Further downstream in South Dakota, there is a stretch that is free-flowing for about 100 miles between Gavin's Point Dam near Yankton, South Dakota, and Ponca State Park, not far upstream from Sioux City. But wherever you go along the Missouri River in our region, there's something to see and do that may help us better understand and appreciate the geology, ecology, and history of this significant river. A list of those places would include Fort Union Trading Post National Historic Site, the Missouri Yellowstone Confluence Interpretive Center, the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center in Fort Mandan, Double Ditch Indian Village, and Onaslant and Huff Indian Villages. Plus, several state parks are located along the river, such as Lewis and Clark State Park, Lake Sakakawea, Fort Stevenson, and Cross Ranch State Park. So consider making a concerted effort to become more familiar with the Big Muddy in 2018. There's lots to see and do to help you better understand the significance of the Big Muddy. Just don't get in a fight over it. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a conversation with Better Business Bureau Communications Manager Dan Hendrickson about the top complaints handled by the Bureau.
Have you ever paired up a fine wine with ice cream?
And one of the great things I've ever tasted was a Malbec raspberry ice cream in Buenos Aires.
Fred Plotkin recommends his favorite cities in the world for people who like to eat. And Michael Breen looks at the economic miracle of South Korea.
The most rapid emergence of a nation in history.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Dan Hendrickson. Dan is the communications manager for the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota. He joins us by phone from Burnsville. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Doug.
We're here to talk about the top 10 lists, the top 10 complaints, the top 10 inquiries made to the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota in 2017. What is the purpose of the lists?
You know, I think it just helps us kind of track problems, be it by industry, or also to see what industries people are most curious about, what people are coming to us when they're looking for information about the marketplace, what industries are catching their attention the most.
And how is the information gathered?
You know, basically we start the clock on January 1st, and then we base our statistics on complaints that come in, customer reviews we receive, and phone calls that our resource specialists receive throughout the year, 5 days a week. Here we have people on staff who answer calls from the public and give them advice on marketplace issues, and then those calls are logged and go towards the final totals.
Well, I've known about the complaints and the Better Business Bureau's function in dealing with those for a long time. I didn't realize that you had reviews as well.
You bet. We offered that, started offering that back in 2014. It's now BBB system-wide, and we just felt, you know, we did a lot of surveys, talked to the public, and the one thing that kept coming up time and time again, we asked people, what else could we be doing, what else should we be doing, and customer reviews topped the list every single time. So finally in 2014, we said, look, we need to start doing this, and our system we feel is a little bit different from a lot in that you can't just fire off a customer review and we'll put it up on our website. We actually share that with the business and give them a week to respond, and they also have the option to say, wait a second, where's this coming from? We never had this customer. So we really do a good job of reviewing every customer review that comes our way and giving companies a chance to respond.
So these reviews are screened. But, you know, when I go online and I go to Amazon or some place that's selling me something, I see these product reviews and I get a little bit suspicious sometimes because I'm thinking somebody might be stuffing the ballot box. Can that happen?
It can. Yeah, no doubt about it. No system is perfect. We do our best. We check IP addresses. If we see the same review come in from the same IP address twice, we weed it out. And if it keeps happening, we will tell the person, look, if this keeps happening, you're going to lose your ability to post here on our site. So we do our best, but you know, we grant that not every system, there is no perfect system. And certainly we look for commonalities, certain phrases that maybe keep popping up. And we will follow up if we do have a feeling that, like you said, the box is being stuffed.
I suspect that sometimes, occasionally, somebody might call a business and complain and then say, and I'm going to call the BBB and complain, and then I'm going to write a bad review about you. Can that person do that?
You know, we give them the option. We give them the option to either file a complaint or file a customer review. If we gave them both options, we feel like it's kind of having two bites at the same apple. And we kind of look at it this way. If a customer is looking for a concrete resolution, if they say, wait a second, I'm due a refund or the company needs to come out here and address this, we encourage them to file a complaint. If it's more for other people's knowledge, if they want to say, hey, this company was great to deal with and I want people to know this, or conversely, this company was not so great, I want people to know this, then we encourage them to file a customer review.
Is it significant that reviews by customers are up while complaints are down a bit? I noted that in your news release.
We feel that is the case. We feel there is a correlation. We've noted as our complaint statistics have dropped in recent years, we've noticed our customer review statistics have gone up. So it almost kind of balances really closely, we feel, even maybe a bit of a surplus in terms of total interactions with us or people turning to us to file either a complaint or customer review. But, you know, again, those customer reviews, it's powerful. And we know a lot of people, that's kind of the first place they turn. They want to see what other customers had to say about a business or product. And so, again, this is just another way we're trying to evolve and trying to give the public what they want.
How would you characterize the reviews? Are they mostly positive or are they complaints?
You know, actually, it's surprising. We weren't quite sure when we rolled this out. We kind of thought it might be, you know, 50-50, but each year we've seen a slight increase towards the positive. In 2017, 68% of the reviews we received through BBB were positive.
Let's get into the kind of the weeds a bit here. When should you complain? You gave us a bit of an example, but when and how should you complain to the Better Business Bureau?
We always encourage people to take it up with the company first, start there, see if you can't work it out directly. Quite often, you know, businesses are surprised when they receive a complaint. They say, well, wait a second, I never heard from this customer. We didn't even know they were unhappy. Now, obviously, people have a right to file a complaint whenever they want to, but we do encourage that first step of doing everything you can to work it out with the company. And if you feel like, no, I'm just beating my head against the wall here, I need someone else to kind of step in and play a role, that's when we encourage people to file a complaint with us. Or if you can't find the business, if the business suddenly goes off the radar or just won't answer your phone calls, definitely turn to us then, file a complaint. We'll do whatever we can to kind of get the cart back on the track.
Well, there are unscrupulous people in every profession, in some businesses too, I'm sure. So what if the business owner or the manager says to you, yeah, we never had that customer? Do you take them at their word?
You know, we do to a point. What we'll do is say, okay, let's just go back to the customer one last time, and we'll say, okay, customer, Company X is saying there was no relationship here, and we give the customer then a chance to prove that there was an interaction, be it a receipt, or, you know, they can either flesh out their complaint by saying, look, I spoke to Doug or Jim or Pete, whoever it was, and I can put a name to a face and thereby, you know, they know that I was there. And we will then say, company, look, we've got some pretty good indications here, either the receipt, which shows they were a customer, or, you know, they've got a lot of detail here. We would like to hear more from you on this one.
Well, in your news release, you say that the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota processed just shy of 16,650 complaints in 2017, which is down a bit from the previous year. But when you look at the top 10 industries by volume of complaints, they look kind of familiar to me. Numbers 1 and 3 are auto dealers, new and used.
Exactly, yeah, and we know that. We know, obviously, people's homes and their cars are probably most vital to day-to-day satisfaction, so when there's a problem, we know that we're going to hear about it. As far as the top item, auto dealers new, that is a little bit misleading in that many of the complaints we receive against auto dealers are not about new cars, but so many dealers now sell used cars as well, and we find that most of the complaints actually involve used cars.
Okay. I was taken a bit aback by number 2, which was newspapers. Why are newspapers generating so many complaints?
Well, we know it's an industry that's kind of going through a lot of adjustment right now, and I think part of it is the fact that here in the Twin Cities, we know that the two major papers in town here in recent times merged their delivery services, and so obviously at that time there was a bit of confusion as far as carriers knowing where to go or when to be there. And strictly by volume, we know that, you know, any major marketplace, Fargo-Moorhead, the Minneapolis, St. Paul, we know the more customers you have, the better the odds someone's not going to get their paper on a given day. So it does have to do a lot with delivery issues. And the other issue that seems to keep coming up is subscriptions. People saying, wait a second, now I canceled my bill and now suddenly I'm getting a final bill that no one told me about, or they're still billing me on a monthly basis. Can you help? And that's when we do our best to get involved and try to find a resolution.
So this is newspapers as a business. They're not calling you and complaining about the editorial page.
No, although I wouldn't doubt we've probably gotten a couple of those over the years. But no, it's mostly to do with delivery or, again, subscriptions supposedly being canceled or trying to be canceled and bills still showing up.
Number four on the top 10 industries by volume of complaints is property management, and I'm not surprised about that.
No, we know a lot of people are living in apartments these days, or, you know, condos, what have you. And obviously, the more people you have living in apartments and so forth, the more issues there are going to be. You know, we do find that industry is very responsive, and we know it's a tight market. So we know that they have to be responsive, and they have to get on top of problems. So probably not surprising, like you said, that it's number four on the list.
I was intrigued also by the list of the top 10 industries by consumer inquiries. Number one really caught my attention, because I think it might be because of a blizzard of ads, but pillows is number one.
Yep. You know, obviously we have a major pillow manufacturer here in Minnesota, and they advertise nationally. You'll see them on TV. You'll hear about them on the radio, see them at the airports or at the malls. So yes, they are out there very heavily promoting themselves. And so I think it's fairly natural that a number of people across the country would be turning to us to see, well, okay, well, what's happening with this company, or tell me more about these pillows.
I even got an inquiry from a family member of mine who knew that I happened to have received a couple of these for Christmas and wanted to know what I thought of them. So
yeah,
there I am.
That's not a bad thing. That's, you know, actually, referrals and so forth, that's a big thing too. So I'm glad, actually. That's a good sign.
Number two on that top 10 industries by consumer inquiries is contractors, general contractors. This is an area that I think we all struggle with. When we want somebody to help us remodel or whatever, how can we be sure we're getting somebody who's not going to take us to the cleaners, as has recently happened in this community with a particular company?
Well, you know, I know in Fargo-Moorhead there was a company that went under recently or went out of business kind of suddenly, and that happens. We know that happens. So I think, you know, the fact that people are turning to us to try to find reliable contractors is a good thing. We know it's a big dollar purchase in many cases, sometimes a few thousand, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars. So you want to be sure that the company has a good track record. Other steps you can take, of course, would be looking with the Secretary of State there in North Dakota to make sure they're licensed, and in Minnesota here, checking with the Department of Labor and Industry.
I went up to the Better Business Bureau site, and anybody can. It's BBB.org, easy to find, and you put in your city name or your zip code, and it'll give you localized information. The BBB site allows ads. I didn't realize that. I asked for a plumbing renovation recommendation in Moorhead just to test it out, and I got a list of plumbers headed by ads for plumbing contractors in the Twin Cities.
Yep, we have a search feature here, and actually accredited businesses here in Minnesota and North Dakota can purchase kind of premier placements, basically, where they'll pop up near the top of the list. And, yeah, that search is a big thing. We're excited about it. We revamped it recently, and we're trying to get people to use it as a place to find reliable contractors, auto dealers, you name it, really any kind of business or product you're looking for. We'd like to be among the top of the list, if not the top of the list, when people are looking for reliable firms.
Well, we talked about complaints and inquiries and these reviews. Can the reviews be accessed to help a consumer make a decision about a product or service, sort of like you would with Angie's List or a Homesy Design or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. We in the reports, our business profiles, we put complaints and reviews together so people can kind of get a full picture of first what kind of complaints have come in, how did the company respond. We publish complaint detail. And then also from there, they can look at customer reviews. We rate them by positive, negative, neutral. so people can get a quick snapshot of what other people's experiences have been and use that as another factor to consider.
I noticed on your two lists, the top 10 industries by volume of complaints, the top 10 industries by consumer inquiries, that under inquiries, number three was mail order and catalog shopping. What are they interested in finding out? I would have expected that to be in the complaint list.
Well, I think there too, you know, so much shopping has turned to online or people shopping from their homes. I think they want to be sure that the sites they're visiting, the companies behind those sites, are reputable and have a good track record, or at least find out what their track record has been. And obviously, we know many people are purchasing all manner of things, from groceries to supplies to any number of products. So I think, again, anytime you're putting your credit card out there, you want to make sure that the company behind the website is going to be reputable and take care of you.
Well, the Better Business Bureau has been around for a very long time. And, of course, now we're in the 21st century, and so much of what we do is online. And we've been talking about what is available online from the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota. How is the enterprise, first of all, the Better Business Bureau, funded? And what is sort of the vision for this company going into the future now?
You bet. Well, basically, we're funded by member dues. We have businesses that choose to be accredited by us. We check them first for background problems. We look at their complaint history. We make sure, in some cases, if their industry requires licensing, we check on that. And if they choose then to become accredited, they pay a yearly fee, which entitles them to use our logo in their advertising. They can also take advantage of trainings we offer, networking opportunities, a number of different things that membership entails. And then from there, here in Minnesota and North Dakota, we have roughly 7,300 member companies or accredited businesses. And basically the vision today is the same as it was back in 1912 when BBB was founded here in the Twin Cities, which is a marketplace where buyers and sellers trust each other, really just trying to make sure the marketplace stays fair, that people know that there's a place they can turn when there are problems. And really trying to encourage business ethics among businesses and really just remind people that there is a right and wrong and it matters.
Well, we all like that idea. What is the advantage for the business? Is it just to say we are a Better Business Bureau affiliate or something like that?
Well, we know that we're highly recognized. We know that a great deal of consumers recognize Better Business Bureau, know what we stand for. So, yeah, I think when people look online or look at a business profile and see that the company has chosen to become accredited, I think people think, well, okay, you know, it sounds the Better Business Bureau has done some diligence here and looked into the company to determine they can be accredited or are worthy to be accredited. And from there, they know, too, that we hold, you know, some people have always said, well, you know, ratings are for sale. You become a member and BBB hands you a good rating. Not true. We actually hold accredited businesses to a higher standard. So if there are problems, we will work directly with the customer and get in touch with the business and say, look, we got a problem here. We need to figure it out or find an answer. And we'll do our best every time to do that, whether the complaint's against an accredited business or a non-accredited business.
Dan Hendrickson is Communications Manager for the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota. If you're interested in inquiring about a business or seeing the complaints about a business or reviews about a business, go to bbb.org. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Doug.
Up next on Main Street, Dakota Date Book.
Prairie Public Education Services is hosting a series of free professional development workshops featuring area teachers, PBS resources, and best tech tips. Interactive sessions for every grade level and content area happening weekly. Join in person at the Prairie Public Station in Fargo or join virtually via webinar. Go to prairiepublic.education.org for more information and to sign up.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 6th. North Dakota remembers World War I. With thousands of American troops now at the front in France on this date in 1918, food conservation had become critical. A new guide was issued which called for at least one wheatless meal each day except Monday, when no wheat products were allowed. Tuesday was a meatless day, and most days required at least one meal without meat. No pork products were allowed on Saturday. All sugar and fats were to be used sparingly, but potatoes and other vegetables were not restricted. Public eating houses were allowed to sell pies, donuts, cookies, and other pastries on Wheatless Monday as long as they contained one-third wheat flour substitutes. This included cornmeal, corn flour, and corn starch, and products made from rice, barley, oats, soybeans, potatoes, sweet potatoes, and buckwheat. The responsibility to adhere to these regulations rested not only on the housewife, but also on the retailers. Dr. E.F. Ladd, the North Dakota Food Administrator, issued a warning to retailers that noncompliance could mean the loss of their retail license. Retailers were allowed to sell only 24 to 49 pounds of flour per family living in a town. Families in the country were allowed 49 to 98 pounds, and ranchers coming from a long distance could obtain a barrel of flour, but not to exceed a 60-day supply. And for each 7 pounds of flour, 3 pounds of flour substitute were required to be sold. Sugar was also heavily regulated. Home consumption was limited to 3 pounds per family per month, though purchasing a 2-month supply was okay. Farmers and ranchers who traveled greater distances could obtain even longer-lasting supplies in one trip, 50 to 100 pounds. Dr. Melvin Gilmore of the State Historical Society of North Dakota believed that self-reliance on resources long available in North Dakota could ease the burden of food conservation. Just as lignite coal has helped ease the coal shortage, if North Dakotans developed a taste for corn, which local native tribes had used as a staple for centuries, it could reduce the need for wheat. Although the state was relatively treeless, large groves of box elders were common. A relative of the sugar maple, box elders could be used as a source of sugar, if tapped in the coming spring. Gilmore believed that by studying Native American customs, North Dakotans could become less dependent upon scarce commodities. It was their patriotic duty in a time of war. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
It may be a stormy time for the world's financial markets, but one economist says investors shouldn't panic.
It is a bit like the weather. You're going to have a whole lot of nice days in a row. The worst time to leave your house is to say, oh my goodness, we're having a big storm. Let's get out of here. You know, that's a recipe to get wet.
We'll have the latest on which way the market winds are blowing and what it means for the economy on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
I want to take a moment here just to thank those people who participated in our short and sweet membership drive. We said it was ending on midday Saturday, but we're actually going to extend it for those people who want to, you know, pick up the phone and make a call and get that pound of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry before the next holiday, which is, of course, Valentine's Day. It's easy to do. Just give us a call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. And for those of you, again, who did participate, who did become members or up your membership during our short and sweet membership drive, thank you very much. Wednesday on Main Street, Annie Duke is one of the most famous women in professional poker. And tomorrow we'll talk about how she uses the lessons of poker in her work as a decision strategist and leadership consultant. Duke is the author of Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.